versus Barrett. Mr. Martin?
It pleases the court. Good morning, Your Honors. It was the money laundering guideline that resulted in Mr. Barrett's 151-month prison sentence. But at the sentencing hearing, if you read the record, the district court essentially skipped over the money laundering guideline. At the outset of the hearing, the court noted the base offense levels for money laundering, commented that there had been objections to the quote loss figure, and then the parties devoted.
Well, now, do we know how much money passed between Plymouth and Repco or whatever it was? This money that went in a circle. So money would be paid to Repco so that Repco would think that it was getting paid off on the receivables, and then it would lend it back, in effect, to Barrett's. And so it would go in a circle.
That's
so
correct.
Do we know how much of that money went in? Was that the $250 million?
The circle was $289 million.
$289 million. Well, why wouldn't the $289 million be a good estimate of the value of the laundered funds? I mean, all this money was laundered in the sense of being moved around for purposes of fraud.
That's my question, if I could just follow up, because even if a substantial portion of the money was recycled, why would it matter if they were separate transactions? In other words, doesn't each instance of money laundering amount to a distinct offense and result in a distinct harm?
That may be correct, Your Honor. The question is, and I'll back up for a minute, because you're dealing with a table that says impose the value of the funds. And the guidelines do not define that term. The commentary does not define that term. I think that engenders a question of whether, what does value mean? Is it net? Is it gross? The government asked for essentially...
Well, that $289 million was all laundered, as Judge Rovner said. You know, every time a phony payment was made to Repco, of the so-called payment of a receivable, that was money laundering, wasn't it?
Yes, according to
the... So, the amount that was laundered in this fashion was $289 million.
Well, it's our position...
You got a break. The only... I don't know, there's a figure of what, $75 million is arbitrary, but seems like the entire amount that traveled in these circles was laundered.
The probation officer didn't take that position. The government didn't take that position. Mr. Barrett.
Why isn't it a sensible position, though?
In many instances, when this court is dealing with analysis of proceeds of money laundering or proceeds in general, the question is asked whether it should be net proceeds or gross proceeds. And this court always seems to come out on the side of the net proceeds position. And to say it is the gross proceeds, it was not a finding made by the...
I don't understand that. The money laundering is a fraudulent device. It's a device for fraud. And it's punished separately. You want to collapse it into the fraud. You want to say, well, whatever loss was caused by the fraud, that's the value of the funds for the money laundering. But then there's no separate money laundering offense, in effect.
Well, there is a money laundering offense because you look at the net for the overall offense. And it's our position that it should be the amount which was injected into the scheme as opposed to just recycling the money over and over. If I take $10 and I withdraw it from the bank...
It's the amount of the fraud, isn't it, that you're saying?
The
amount that was stolen is what you regard as the value of value the funds for the money laundering?
That's the position that the government took. And the government.
What's your position?
Our position would be the net.
Even smaller, presumably.
Smaller, obviously.
Yeah.
But the net injected.
But the point is, you're tying the value of funds for money laundering purposes to the size of the amount of the fraud, the amount of the stolen.
That's what the government did. That's what, in the district court, Mr. Barrett's position was that recycling money over and over again, it inflates.
I don't understand that. The recycling, that's the crime. That's the money laundering. Doing it over and over and over again.
Well, you have to look at the word value, and what does the word value mean? The value of the money laundered.
Well, clearly, the value of the money laundered is $289 million. That's what it was. That's the amount.
Well, the value of the money laundering to Mr. Barrett, in light of the district court's findings, would be the amount of loss. And the point is, just to back up, is the district court did not make any findings on this. It did not address the objections, did not object.
You don't have to. I mean, if $289 million is the amount laundered, what additional findings do you need?
But there were three different positions before the district court, and the
but
court...
But this is the sensible one, I think. Because your position, or the government, in the government's position, doesn't treat money laundering as a separate offense. It just treats it as another name for fraud.
The government position essentially imputes a number of transactions table into the money laundering guideline. That's not there. You see number of transactions tables elsewhere in the guidelines, like the more than one bribe guideline, the amount of guns, things like that. There is no reason why the magnitude of the criminal harm can't be addressed by the net.
Could we talk about the guidelines?
Sure.
Because if he were to be resentenced under the 2002 guidelines, why wouldn't he get the two-level enhancement for sophisticated laundering? In other words, I'm wondering if, you know, he'd be in a worse position.
We would not be in a worse position. At the outset, the two-level enhancement for sophisticated laundering is a determination for the district court to make. And let's say that we assume, based on this record, that there is sophisticated laundering. He is still, with 3 points off for acceptance of responsibility, one level lower under the 2002 guidelines than he was under the 1997 guidelines.
Yeah, but the government seems to be suggesting that it would not agree to a third point for the acceptance of responsibility.
Well, that's what they say now.
Well, it's a pretty good indication of what they'll say then.
Well, and I'll back up that, because there is a guideline that states what guideline should be applied is either the guideline in effect at the time of the offense or the guideline in effect at the time of sentencing, whichever is lower. In this case, the government contends that relevant conduct went into 2002. Well, in 2002, there was the amended money laundering guideline to take away this value of funds table that, by the way, the Sentencing Commission has found arbitrary. And in 2002, there was no requirement for a government motion for the third acceptance of responsibility point. So if you apply the guidelines in effect at the time of the offense, according to the government, we don't need to rely on a government motion for the third point. The other thing is that in the district court, the government took the position in its submission to the probation department that Mr. Barrett was entitled to the 2 points off for acceptance and a third point off for timeliness of acceptance.
Did he forfeit or waive his challenge?
It's our position that this is forfeiture as opposed to waiver. And the reason for that is that waiver requires the intentional relinquishment of a known right. And there's no point in the proceeding where the district court turned to Mr. Barrett and said, Mr. Barrett, you know what? You have a right to be sentenced under the new guidelines or the amended guidelines. Do you want to give up that right? Of course, he would have said no because the sentence would have been lower. So there was no waiver by Mr. Barrett. What happened here was the government initially said the 1997 guidelines apply, but they only looked at the fraud guidelines. There was no comparison of the money laundering guidelines. And I find that I'm just troubled by it because the money laundering is the high sentence here, and everybody seems to be arguing about the fraud. And the probation officer did the same thing. The probation officer compared the fraud guidelines. Of course, the new fraud guidelines are higher than the old fraud guidelines, and didn't undertake any comparison of the money laundering guidelines. And Mr. Barris's counsel did the same thing. Waiver.
I don't understand that. Can a lawyer waive an issue for his client or not?
It depends on the type of issues. There's some issues, obviously, a lawyer cannot waive. I mean, a lawyer couldn't waive a...
Yes, I know, but can he waive the... First, apparently, the lawyer, at least, thought that the 1997 guidelines were more advantageous, really wanted the sentence to be under them.
The lawyer did not undertake a comparison of the money laundering guidelines. There's no comparison in this record, and nobody addressed the lawyer. No one asked the lawyer, do you want to exercise your right to be sentenced under the new guidelines or the old guidelines? The lawyer never answered that question for Mr. Barrett. It's just not there. Everyone assumed the 97 guidelines applied, and that's negligence. And when negligence occurs, it gives rise to a forfeiture analysis as opposed to waiver. And if you apply the forfeiture analysis, first question, is there error? Well, under the 2002 guidelines, the sentence would be at least one level lower, so there's error. Is it plain? Yes, it's plain, because the guidelines were in effect at the time of sentencing. And is there prejudice? And this is where the government and Mr. Barris part ways. I think I previously addressed the prejudice. The prejudice is that Mr. Barris's sentences would have been lower. And as far as the fourth element of the plain error analysis, the government really doesn't argue that, but if a man's spending a few years more in prison than he's supposed to be...
How old is he?
He was 58 at the time of the sentencing hearing, so he might be 59 now.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, thank you, Mr. Martin. Mr. Young?
May it please the court, Rick Young on behalf of the United States. Defendant contends that the district court did not provide sufficient findings with respect to its determination that the value of the funds laundered in this case was $75 million. However, the district court accepted and adopted the findings and calculations of the probation officer as set forth in the PSR, and those findings and conclusions were not clearly erroneous. If anything...
I don't understand what the $75 million has to do with the amount laundered, because your theory seems to be that every time one of these phony payments was made, that was laundering, and that's the $289 million.
I think that's correct, Your Honor. I believe the government as well as the court took an overly conservative approach in the district court. As we indicated in our brief, if you look at the 11th Circuit decisions in Martin and Berrios, they took that same analysis where they essentially added up the various transactions to arrive at a laundered at the total amount or the value of the funds involved in the laundered transaction. Here, the court, and as well as the government, did take a more conservative approach. Certainly that was not a detriment to the defendant in this case. If anything, he's made comments about the fact that the court hasn't, or the district court, did not consider the net proceeds or conducted a gross analysis as opposed to a net analysis. If anything, that appears to be what the court was doing by focusing upon the $75 million, which was the maximum credit line available to REFCO under the agreement with Plymouth at any particular time. In essence, that was the amount of fictitious receivables that defendant had sold to REFCO at any particular time, and the court determined that that was the amount he intended to launder. So certainly, I think the court is right that the district court could have taken a much more generous approach to laundering. Defendant criticizes the district court for considering loss, arguing that loss and value of the funds are distinct concepts. The government certainly agrees with that analysis. However, to the extent the court may have confused the subject, which we don't believe it did, it certainly wouldn't have been a detriment to the defendant. Courts have rejected loss as an indicator of the value of the funds in situations where it underestimates the value of the funds. And if anything, that's what happened in this case. At a minimum.
I'm troubled by your attempt to brush off the district judge's comment about the downward departure. Because she said, all right, now you had a position for a downward departure. Don't you know that those don't exist anymore except in cooperation agreements, but go ahead. So then they go ahead, and so she's letting them argue, but she started off by saying that there is no possibility. So I don't know how you conclude from that she was actually exercising her discretion. And also at the end of this, after he, you know, lawyer finished his spiel all about Barrett's being charismatic and so forth and the like, she says, thank you. And she says, is there anything you would like to say on your own behalf, Mr. Barrett? So it sounds as if she's just been listening to this plea for a downward departure as a matter of politeness, rather than actually considering that, you know, she has the power to grant it.
There are two reasons why we believe that the defendant hasn't overcome the presumption that the district court understood the law. The first being that despite making those comments, she did entertain argument on the motion, quite extensive argument for that matter, taking up approximately 10 pages of transcript. Secondly, to the extent she made the comments about cooperation agreements or departures only being applicable in cooperation situations, she appeared to be referring to the then recently passed PROTECT Act.
But why would she? That would be completely irrelevant.
Exactly. She was applying the 1997 version of the guidelines, not the 2000
version. So why did she say that?
As we indicate in our brief, we believe it was meant as sarcasm.
Well, what's your basis for that?
Well, as I indicated, the fact that she nonetheless entertained the argument, and the fact that it really wasn't relevant to this case.
She listened. She allowed the argument to proceed. Not clear if she entertained it, because at the end she just said, thank you, and then asked Barrett whether he had anything to say. It doesn't sound as if, I mean, that's actually more consistent with her believing she didn't have discretion to grant that, because usually if she thought she was listening to a real argument for a motion for a downward departure, she'd say at the end, thank you, motion denied. She didn't say that.
Well, nevertheless, she entertained the argument. Well, she listened to the argument.
Nevertheless, what? I don't understand that.
But the PROTECT Act wouldn't have been applied in that situation,
yeah,
regardless of what
she
may have thought.
Yeah, but she knew that, right? Because otherwise, she says, don't you know those don't exist anymore?
That's correct, but that wasn't relevant to the version of the guy that she was applying. I don't know why she said it, Your Honor. But I don't think it was relevant to her decision in this particular case.
Well, how do you know?
For the reasons I've stated, Your Honor.
That's
the government's position.
That's
our position, Your Honor.
Well, you don't have any basis for it.
Well, two reasons I've indicated, Your Honor.
Yeah, but they're no good.
Were you the trial attorney?
I was not, Your Honor.
We look at this on the record. You know, we don't know what her body language was. We don't know what her, you know, I too wondered where the idea that it was sarcastic came from.
Like you, Your Honor, my review was limited to reading the record itself. And as I indicated, for the reasons which I won't reiterate again.
I want to ask you this, because I'm afraid your time will be up and I won't get my answer. Are you saying that the government definitely would not support a third point for acceptance if Mr. Barrett was resentenced under the 2002 guidelines?
Your Honor, at the time of the sentencing in August of 2003, the probation office had made the recommendation that he be not provided any point for acceptance of responsibility based upon his arguments related to the loss amount. The government, in its sentencing memorandum, agreed with that position and took the position of sentencing, essentially, that he was not entitled to any acceptance, let alone the third point for acceptance. So I don't believe
it certainly doesn't seem, when you read through all of this, that the government was particularly bothered by him receiving the third point when Judge Conlon sentenced him. So I'm really at a now I'm afraid I'm a bit mixed up here.
Well, we did take the position in our sentencing memorandum prior to sentencing that he was not entitled to point.
I know, but you were very quiescent below when he sought and received all three points, notwithstanding the probation officer's objection to him receiving any credit. So what I will be very honest with you. I worry when we send these cases back that there will be some sort of, I don't want to use the word vindictive, I don't know what word to use, that, you know, there'll be a change in attitude, so to speak. The government was quiescent during, I mean, you know,
well, I don't believe the court opened it for discussion. Besides that, I think
it's always open for discussion.
If it went back, well, she didn't invite discussion, at least I would have to say.
You know, they
but if it goes back, I don't think our position, if we maintain the position he was not entitled to the third point, would be any different than it was at that point. We argued he wasn't entitled to any point for acceptance of responsibility, let alone a third point off for acceptance of responsibility.
But not a word during the sentencing. Not a word.
And I would note that the court would only get to that issue if you find that the defendant did not waive the application of the 1997 guidelines.
Not necessarily. Even, you know, if he can show that the 2002 guidelines would have resulted in a more favorable sentence.
Well,
so we might be inclined to remand. I don't know.
Well, if the argument's waived, Your Honor.
Well, when you say waived, so what do you think of Mr. Martin's point, which is that if a waiver that's based on not a deliberate strategic, an informed strategic judgment that you're better off, that you're getting something somehow by waiving, but what if it's just a lawyer's mistake? Shouldn't that be treated as a forfeiture and subject to plain error review?
I don't think this is just a lawyer's mistake. I mean, they filed extensive. The defendant had approximately
What advantage, then, was the lawyer seeking by putting these under the 97 guidelines?
I'm not certain, but clearly
wait a second. You're not certain. Possible advantage was he seeking?
I would assume that they believe that had the court accepted their arguments regarding the value of the funds, as well as the loss amount, they'd be in a more favorable position than they would have been otherwise.
Why would that be? Why would they be more favorable than under the 2002 guidelines?
I'm not certain.
Well, you say you're not certain. I'm not interested in certainty. Is there a possibility that the 97 guidelines would be more advantageous to a defendant in Barris's position?
There is, Your Honor, because in the current version of the guidelines in effect at the time of the sentencing, the money laundering offense level would have been based upon the offense level for the fraud, essentially. Back in 1997, the base offense level was 23, so it's conceivable, had the court accepted his arguments about there being no loss, he could have had an offense level less than 23 for the loss amount.
She said, even though I don't find any merit in the objection to the loss, she's not, I mean, that would never happen with her now, would it?
I don't understand the question.
Well, I mean, she's already said she doesn't find any merit in the argument that you're positing for him at this point. So, I mean, why in the world would she find it now if she didn't find it then?
I assume her opinion would be the same now as it was
right
then, Your Honor.
Right. So, if you put that into the mix, where are we on the 1997 and the 2002?
As indicated in our brief, we believe they'd be the same. The only difference would be the third point for acceptance of responsibility.
Well,
in other words, if the court accepted our position that we would not have moved to the third point in either event by applying either the 1997 version of the guidelines or applying the 2002 version of the guidelines, the resulting offense level would be 34.
But then how could she go back on that? I mean, here she says, all right, And I am awarding a 3-level reduction for timely acceptance of responsibility, even though I don't find any merit in the objection to the loss. It is a lawyer's argument, not the defendant's renunciation of his acceptance of responsibility, which he acknowledged at the time of the plea, so I will give him the benefit of the doubt on that. Nowhere does it say, excuse me, we don't want him to have any.
The difference is that under the current version of the guidelines, there must be a formal government motion. Under the 1997 version of the guidelines, there was no requirement. So under the current version, she would have had to have asked the government whether intended to move for the third point. She didn't have to do so under the 1997 version, and she didn't do so.
And also, we've got that 2-point upward for sophistication in the 2002, right?
That's correct, Your Honor.
And I mean, he could really come out of this a lot worse, couldn't he?
Under the current version?
Yeah.
As I've indicated, under the current version, we believe it would be the same. The only way, or the one way conceivably get worse is if the court would reconsider the laundering aspect, as your court's indicated, but the laundering amount may actually be the $290 million and not
Now you're contradicting yourself, because earlier you said he could have been better off under 97 guidelines. Now you're saying he wouldn't be worse off under the 2002 guidelines. So they don't go together.
Right. I mean, ultimately, we believe that the sentence would be the same under either version,
right,
Your Honor.
So then what reason would he have had to waive the 2002 guidelines if he was facing the same sentence under both sets?
In our opinion, yes. I think because of his related maintenance arguments about the loss, he felt he may have been looking at a lesser sentence.
Okay. Well, thank you, Mr. Young.
Yes. Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Martin, how much time do you have? 2 minutes?
Your Honor, I have struggled to envision a scenario where the sentence under the 1997 guidelines with respect to money laundering would have been lower, and I couldn't come up with one, because if the district court accepted the no-loss argument, you have a base offense level of 6, and you add certain things like more than minimal planning and leadership, but you don't get up to 23, which is the base offense level for money laundering under the 97 guidelines.
But if you factor in what we know is going to happen at this point, which is the government is going to ask that the 3 points for responsibility not be awarded, you're in some trouble here, aren't you?
Well, the guideline that should apply is the pre-April 30th, 2003 guidelines, the 2002 guidelines. It contains the amended money laundering guideline and no requirement for a government motion for the third acceptance point. And on top of that, it was in effect at the time of the offense.
In concrete terms, what do you see the range?
Well, it depends on the sophisticated enhancement. The bottom with no sophisticated enhancement is 108. The bottom with the sophisticated enhancement and the acceptance of responsibility is 135.
So either way, you think you...
Yes. And there is no value of funds table in the new guidelines. So taking into account the full value of the funds laundered, as this court has indicated, doesn't add anything. And I would just note that there should be a distinction on the third acceptance point. It's one thing to accept responsibility and not accept responsibility. It's another thing to do so early. And that's what the third point's concerned with. And there's no question that here, Mr. Barrett's pled guilty early, and he proffered and cooperated. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much to both counsel. Next case.